This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
Well, tariffs and trade wars weighing on the market as the blue chip averages move into negative territory for the week and negative territory for the year. The correction seems to be hitting all across every major index. Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava. Welcome to this week's edition of the Financial Sense News Hour. Coming up in the first hour, John Kosar will join me from Asbury Research. He's going to talk about how the major indexes failed their breakout patterns. He feels that stocks could get even weaker and we may see bond yields fall to 2.6%. Just when everybody thought rates were rising, John says they could be going the opposite direction. And we're going to pick up on a theme that we talked about in April with John. He said the commercials had the largest short position in oil, and they have been getting killed in that position. If they reverse it, we could possibly see a spike of oil prices to $100 a barrel. You're going to want to hear John's thinking on that. Later on in the program, Ned Schmidt will be joining us. And if you're looking at the grains this month, they're all down. We've got wheat prices down 10-12%, soybean down. All of this is related to the tariffs that could go into effect next week. And we'll see who blinks first, China or the U.S. The one with the biggest market is the U.S., and we have the biggest negotiating power. And, of course, Ryan Poplava will be here in Hour 1 as we talk about what moved the markets this week. All of that coming up in the first hour.
And I'm John Loeffler, and today on The Big Picture, Jim is going to do an extensive interview with Greg Weldon, the subject, Taking Shelter in the Storm, as we take a very, very close look here at stagflation, at rising budget deficits, and higher inflation rates, not to mention a mountain of debts that the markets aren't priced in. And we'll also discuss why the Fed may be using hawkish language, but not be really quite as hawkish as the markets would anticipate. That's going to be the big picture, hour two of the Financial Sense News Hour. And this is our want every single week. We turn to Ryan Poplava, CEO of Financial Sense. And what we do is talk about the drivers and catalysts which influence the market. So, Ryan, here we are. I can't believe it. 4th of July coming up in the middle of the week, but it's the end of another quarter, and we're already halfway through the summer, it seems like.
Halfway through the year.
Halfway through the year, yeah. Although, for me, summer is sort of May through September, you know, something like that. That's psychologically. What can you tell us about the way we ended this week, and how may things look going forward into next week?
John, at the heart of concern over the past, 4 months now, but essentially also this week, it's trade. It's been the topic of discussion daily. And also, you know, depending on what kind of tweets come through from Trump. So that's where we're at. And this week, there was an article by the Wall Street Journal at the start of the week that the U.S. Treasury is preparing rules that would block firms with at least 25% Chinese ownership from buying U.S. companies involved in industrially significant technology. So the article also went on to discuss that they're also looking at ways to increase controls over technology from being shipped to China. So very China targeted. And of course, things have been kind of frayed there because there's a lot of back and forth between Trump, trade, and China. And throughout the week, though, they were trying to de-escalate some of that verbiage because, again, that wasn't directly from anything Trump said or the White House. That was just an article from the Wall Street Journal. And so immediately on Monday, you had trade advisor Peter Navarro. You had Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin, who said, "We're not targeting China." And then Larry Kudlow as well, and many others throughout the week spending time with the media to kind of diffuse this notion that we're specifically targeting China and that these provisions were meant to prevent them or other foreigners from investing in the country. And that caused the markets to calm down a little bit late afternoon after Navarro said, you know, the sell-off was large overreaction and that there were no plans to impose investment restrictions on any country. That caused the S&P to rally off the lows. At one point, we were down 2% on Monday. We eventually only closed down about 1.2%. And then throughout the week, there was another comment from Trump himself at the White House that kind of raised some confidence over this issue not being as big of a deal, not really targeting China specifically. He said that he was in favor of a softer approach to protect intellectual rights through the Committee on Foreign Investments in the U.S. That's the CFIUS. And they largely, you know, look at approve things on a normal basis. They've been doing it since, I believe it was put together in the 70s and was later amended in 2007. So that was a real positive view that rather than a more direct intervention from the White House, they're again deferring to already things that are in place. And another catalyst late in the week came from a Chinese government announcement for an ease on restrictions surrounding foreign investment in financials, agriculture, and manufacturing industries. They had actually announced that earlier on, but just again reaffirming. But of course, we continue to hear that Trump doesn't think the Chinese efforts have met his requirements yet. That's why we continue to see that there is an escalation and they are looking at more tariffs. So in other news, though, specifically in trade, Canada is considering a steel tariff because they're getting a flood of imports now going around the U.S., not coming in here, instead rerouting to Canada. And that's hurting their industry there. So they're talking about raising tariffs. Of course, whenever you do tariffs, there's unintended consequences. Here's an example of it. Another one is Harley-Davidson. They're talking about moving production out of the U.S. to avoid some of the reverse tariffs that are dealing with the EU and others on U.S. vehicles. And so, again, unintended consequences that can happen from tariffs. And the U.S. State Department said they're planning major sanctions on any country that doesn't cut oil imports from Iran to zero by November 4th. So there you have it, John. Very busy week in trade. That led to that initial shock in stocks and that weakness on Monday, but did lead to a rally from those lows off of some of the softer language we got from Trump and some of his advisors.
You know, I've been watching this whole trade dispute, and if we go back to NAFTA back in the 1990s, I think it's when we debated that and ran it through, and this was a big hot controversy. And it was the North America Free Trade Agreement, if you remember that. Mm-hmm. And it was 20,000 pages, and I kept thinking, if we're just saying we're going to have free trade, doesn't that just take a page? You know, does it really take 20,000 pages? Which really means that the titles that politicians put on bills and treaties oftentimes do the opposite of what's actually in the guts of it. It's meant to sell the issue rather than tell you what's going on inside. So that's wise to keep in mind when you're dealing with politicians, you know. CNBC recently did a poll this week, too, that showed while many don't approve of the handling of immigration, I mean, it's still a hot button, and let's face it, our system's broken and it really needs a lot of reform. Yeah. And Congress is reneging on its responsibilities to do that. Nevertheless, President Trump's economic approval rating, by the way, has climbed 6 points to 51%, with only 36% of the public disapproving. And that is a first in his presidency. And, you know, you can also somewhat see that being reflected in the stock market, with the United States outperforming many, many of its peers. It's interesting how things are moving here in the country. Perception versus reality and different ratings on one area that really don't reflect what's going on somewhere else. Okay. Anyway, moving on. Ryan, what else would you like to share with listeners this week that you think of import is reigning?
You mentioned something that I think is very key, in that the U.S. has been outperforming many of its peers. And this wasn't a major news event or catalyst, but if you're following along in all of the financial markets, you'll note that the Chinese Shanghai Stock Exchange Composite entered bear market territory at some point this week, almost down 20%. Of course, we rallied back towards the end of the week, up a fair amount off of that Chinese announcement to allow for investments in. And of course, they also lowered their reserve requirement, and they're talking about doing it some more. So the Chinese have taken immediate steps with a drop in their reserve requirements. But you said the U.S. is outperforming its peers. And if you look at over the last just 10 years or even 15 years, as we've seen emerging markets, a rollover in activity as well as those stock indices, the U.S. was never all that far behind. In some cases, maybe half a year, a few months, or maybe a full year, but eventually, you know, weakness abroad can affect us here. So it's something that we definitely want to track and follow. And the emerging markets ETF, iShares, EEM, did the same thing, almost entering into bear market territory of a correction of 20% or more. You know, there's a lot, John, but looking at what else happened this week. But if I focus on just a few things here for our listeners, the key areas, I would have to say it's higher energy prices. Of course, that news from the State Department on sanctions was a part of it, but also there was a draw of about 9.9 million barrels from U.S. crude inventories, along with the news, of course, from last week that OPEC is going to supply a little less than we were expecting. Originally, we were expecting around about 1 million barrels. Russia wanted to do, I think, a little bit more. It ends up that they're probably going to only be able to do, estimates are around between 500,000 to 600,000 barrels per day, just based on, again, backlogs and other disruptive issues in a lot of different places. But crude is back at its highs, which helped oil be essentially one of the few areas that investors could hide in this week from all the weakness that we saw both on Wednesday and Monday. And then U.S. Secretary Perry said, interestingly, that higher crude output may be a little short of what's required to prevent an oil price spike. So he had that also to say this week, and that has had an effect on pricing there. The other important catalyst this week, John, if I could hit on it, is the capital returns that were approved by the Fed for many of the major banks and money centers this week, which came in, I think, Thursday afternoon. It was after markets, and I think we were able to really see the reaction on Friday morning. And this came just in time because the financial sector had been down. If you look at the S&P financial sector, it had been down about 13 consecutive days in the market. And that, just looking at the situation with the financials, most of them got approved to increase their stock buybacks and dividends. One of the analysts at KBW estimated that it's around $80 billion may be released from this. Morgan Stanley and Goldman Sachs were the two that were held back, and State Street was asked to improve its counterparty risks. And then finally, Deutsche Bank failed its capital tests, as many actually expected. So that helped the financial sector. And of course, the financial sector is, you know, it's a big deal. It's the second largest weighting in the S&P 500.
Indeed. And, you know, the financials are a big deal as the second largest weighting in the S&P 500. And they've been beaten down by the pancake. I mean, the yield curve.
There we go again.
Well, it sort of looks like a pancake, right?
Flatter than a pancake. It's a crepe.
It's a crepe? Really? What do you put on it? What is the 2 to 10 year spread narrow to anyway?
I got that from Talladega Nights, but at one point it got down to around 32 basis points. That's the lowest we've seen in about a decade. Remember, we were talking about it about a month ago when it was at a 42 point spread. So right. 32.
So they needed those capital approvals to encourage a little buying. Yeah. 13 days down in a row. All right. Well, is there anything else you want to highlight except the U.S. markets will be closed for the 4th of July and open for a half day on the 3rd this week? Anything else that we're poking at here?
Something I touched on very lightly last week, talking about Powell for the first time really admitting that there might be some issues to growth due to all the trade rhetoric and changes there with tariffs. The other comment that we got this week was from the president of the Federal Reserve Bank of Atlanta, Raphael Bostic, who said, the more trade tensions progress in this more contentious way, the more it pulls me to feel like the risks are on the downside of the broader economy, adding, there is some likelihood I'll be moving away from 4 rate hikes as a real possibility. And, you know, there you have it, John. I see the Fed backpedaling here. I believe that going forward with 4 rate hikes, while we've got all this trade, while we've got the Shanghai down 20%, you've got emerging markets falling, and eventually this does come to roost and it does affect the world economy, the US. And if the Fed isn't looking at abroad what's going on, you know, that concerns me. And I felt like it was a mistake to move forward on four rate hikes, but that's debatable, right? Because we continue to see the CPI, a lot of price components of a lot of the manufacturing data that we get on a weekly and monthly basis have all been showing that we're at record levels and those have been going up. So rock in a hard place, right? We've got trade issues, a lot of rhetoric there, a lot of currency issues too. We don't talk about it a whole lot, just a little bit, where we're seeing a lot of currencies pegged to the US dollar are really in a place where we could be seeing a crisis down the road. You look at the renminbi, just recently has dropped almost, I think this week, to the same levels that we saw in 2015 and 2016 that caused a scare, and a scare that capital was leaving at an alarming rate. So again, there's pockets of some things to be concerned about. Of course, the US is moving full speed ahead on its manufacturing, full employment, spending is up. For the most part, our economy looks good. But again, you got to look at these price situations. And I believe Jim and his interview with Weldon really focus on that. So again, a lot of stuff going on this week. Again, the Fed maybe backpedaling a little bit from four rate hikes to three. It'll be interesting to track, and then the influence that has on the yield curve going forward.
You know, it's interesting as we go through this, we were talking about the North American Free Trade Agreement. And sometimes people will say, well, you know, just report on the economics, don't report on the politics. Because let's face it, I think we're a little oversaturated with it. You can't divorce these two.
No, you can't. There's fiscal policy and monetary policy. Right. You got to look at both.
Yeah, and taxation policy. And they all interact. They all affect each other. And you cannot pull them apart. But we've every so often we get emails from listeners. You shouldn't be talking about the politics and blah, blah, blah. Yeah. Let's face it, we're pretty saturated with what's going on right now. And I even avoid flipping on the TV to avoid some of it at times. But they do interact. There is no way you can deal with it any other way. All right. Interesting times. Ryan Poplav, appreciate it. We'll see you back next week.
Sounds good, John.
Since January, the markets have become more volatile. Uncertainty has returned once again to the financial markets as the Fed continues to raise interest rates and market liquidity has become an issue. We know eventually the Fed rate hikes could lead to another recession and bear market, which would put your portfolio at risk. Do you have an exit plan or a plan to protect your principal during the next market downturn? Well, many of you don't, and that is where Financial Sense Advisors can help. Give us a call and let us help you develop a strategy that helps you navigate both bull and bear markets and give you the peace of mind that you are prepared for any market outcome.
Give us a call at Financial Sense Advisors. Call toll-free 888-486-3939. That's 888-486-3939. Securities offered through Financial Sense Securities Incorporated, member FINRA, SIPC. Advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors Incorporated, a registered investment advisor. You know, Financial Sense NewsHour listeners should remember that our premium members are able to hear the weekday Financial Sense NewsHour featuring interviews with top economic commentators and experts. If you're not a member, here's one of the interviews you missed this week.
Michael, one thing that you wrote on recently was this idea that China can use its large U.S. Treasury holdings as a weapon against the U.S. in a trade war environment. Is that something that China could do and harm the U.S. given how much debt they own?
No, I mean, if they decided to do it in as disruptive way as possible, that would be harmful temporarily for the U.S. Bond market, but it would be harmful because it's harmful to China. In other words, if China were willing to lose a huge amount of money in the liquidation of its government bond portfolios, it could create a short-term disruption in the U.S. bond market. But the idea that China is helping the U.S. by lending it the money for its fiscal deficit is just completely wrong.
Well, the things that used to not matter in the markets are now starting to matter, whether it's political discord, higher oil prices, or trade. Markets not liking this, with the blue chip averages breaking down and back into negative territory. Joining me on the program from Asbury Research is John Kosar. John, I want to talk about some of the big blue chip averages, and that is the breakdown of the Dow Industrials and the Dow Transports. They've broken through their 50-day, and recently they've broken through their 200-day moving average. What do we make of this?
Well, I think, you know, generally speaking, I just went through a bunch of charts here just before you called, and the SOX index, which is a big one for me, that's the semis, the NYSE, the Dow Industrials, and there's a World Index ETF that I track. It's URTH is the symbol. Those are all sitting on or just kind of easing underneath their 200-day. The Dow Transports, there was a bullish breakout. There was a bullish pattern there that failed as of today. So, you know, there's a fail pattern in France. Just kind of jumping overseas for a second. There's a fail pattern in the French ETF. And the reason I look at some of these globals is because, especially the ones that happen to be positively correlated to the S&P 500. So what I make of all of this is that it looks like our market is rolling into correction, and it looks like the cleanest shirt in a dirty hamper, to use that old saw, but, you know, just kind of going around the globe, you know, global indexes, Europe, China, Japan, most of those indexes are already significantly underneath their 200 days. And again, the correlations between these markets and ours is, depending on which index you're looking at, varies. But I mean, we generally move up and down in stocks over the globe at the same time. So I don't think this bodes well.
And when we take a look at the things that are still doing well and have done well, at least they're still in positive territory, it's been the NASDAQ and it's been the small cap indexes, but even things like the Russell are starting to look like they're heading down. How serious would that be if they break down and go through their 200-day moving averages?
Yeah, you know, we're a ways from that happening, but it's a really interesting point and something that I was looking at this morning. Generally speaking, in a healthy bull market, most of the time, you're going to get leadership from technology and secondarily, oftentimes from small cap. What do I mean by that? I mean that usually you'll see the Russell and the NASDAQ 100 or the comp outperforming the S&P 500 in a healthy uptrend. Those typically lead. You also get some leadership from semiconductors as well. I have some indicators here that I put together that basically tracks the relative performance of small cap and tech versus the S&P 500. So I can get a sense of where they are kind of in their quarterly cycle. And both tech and small cap are technically overextended on a quarterly basis versus the S&P. What does that mean? It means that if those two leaders, even though they're still outperforming and they still look good kind of relative to the rest of the market, if they stop being the leaders, if they start to underperform, I think that's what could push a decline in the broad market kind of into second gear. It's in first gear right now. It's just kind of unable to keep its head above water. You know, the S&P has been grinding sideways for months and months, but that's a worry to me. If those two leaders are historically at a place where they peak relative to the S&P and start to roll over, that could be a catalyst to kind of kick this into a new gear on the downside.
I want to talk about something else that we're starting to see. You know, the Fed had its meeting last week, and what struck me was they removed accommodative language. They got rid of forward guidance. They increased their dot plot going to 4 hikes. And then in January, they're going to start having press conferences accompanying every FOMC meeting. So if you look at that meeting itself, it came across as hawkish. Although recently, one Fed governor saying if this trade stuff keeps up, maybe we need to pull back our stance on whether we go 3 or 4. So let's talk about interest rates here, which have pulled back at least on the 10 and the 30.
Yeah, that's an interesting one. And oftentimes, what I've noticed with the interest rate markets is they're very counterintuitive. Like when everybody is really thinking rates are going to go to the moon, that's just the time that they kind of slap you in the head and they turn around and go the other way. I had been looking at a level between 304 and 313 in the 10-year for a couple of months, putting out charts to clients and letting them know that that was a big inflection point. Right when we were in the threes, obviously, that's when the talk of the Fed was raising rates, don't fight the Fed, the market looks great, you know, the economy looks great, you know, go, go, go. That's right about that time that we were up against 313. Well, we traded as high as 311 on a closing basis, and we dropped down quickly, within 8 days, if you can believe that, down to 277. So now we're bouncing around in here. We're in the low 280s the last time I looked. And it looks to me that rates can continue continue to fall. Again, it's counterintuitive, but it looks like I think we can get the yield of the 10-year to 260, 265. And at that point, you know, then I'm going to kind of take a look at everything and see where things stand. So sometimes a counterintuitive mindset with rates is really very good. So, you know, the question you ask yourself is, all right, so we're at 285 now in the 10 right now. Say we go to 262. So the next question is, what gets you there? In my view, what might help to get us there, if not be a kind of a major catalyst, is if the stock market continues to weaken. Again, you know, the globe has kind of broken down and we're following, or, you know, we're still strong stocks-wise relative to most of the rest of the world. But if we continue to weaken here, that's going to push some money out of equities and back into the safety of U.S. Treasuries, which will drive those yields down even farther. So that's kind of how I'm taking two different markets and pairing them up and coming up kind of with a strategic scenario, let's call it, you know, hypothesis of what might happen. And I think we can see that 260 area here this summer. I mean, who knows? You know, the way rates go, they go really quiet for a while and then bam, it's like they jump within just a few days, like the move from 311 down to 277 in the tens. But that's what I'm looking for, is I'm looking for rates to actually drop down into the mid to low 260s here in the 10-year.
Let's talk about what that might imply and whether it's still relevant in this kind of market. And that's an inverted yield curve. Right now, on the day you and I are speaking, there's about a 30 basis point difference between 2-year and 10-year. If your thesis plays out and we get down to 2.6 and we're looking at a 2-year note that is a little over 2.5, and let's say the Fed goes again in September, raises another quarter of a point, what happens when we have a flat yield curve or it begins to invert?
Well, you know, everything that I know about the yield curve is it's not a timing tool. If you try to time the market or put a idea out there in terms of a trade, in terms of an investment, based on what the yield curve's doing now, it's generally not a good idea. It's a forward-looking indicator, and most of the stuff that I've read indicates that after the yield curve turns negative, it could be as much as a year before you go into recession. But that's the implication there, is the flattening curve indicates that the bond market, which is typically more forward-looking than the stock market, is seeing some economic issues ahead, and, you know, it's factoring in those issues and, you know, the way they're pricing treasuries. So realistically, if the curve inverts, you know, it indicates problems around a year ahead, you know, maybe a little bit less than that, but about a year ahead. But maybe some of that warning shot over the bow by the bond market right now is part of what's kind of kept a lid on the stock market rally and has pushed them lower for a while.
I want to move on to something else that's impacting the market. We're seeing it reflected in inflation rates. That's a breakout in crude oil. On the day you and I are speaking, we're looking at crude prices over 73 on West Texas Intermediate crude. And on Brent, we're approaching almost $80 a barrel. And here we are in the middle of summer driving season. I don't know what it's like in your neck of the woods, but in California, we're over $4 a gallon. Let's talk about oil, its impact not only on inflation, but eventually, you know, hitting consumer pocketbooks.
Yeah, I've had my eye on oil for some time. Our last time that we were together was April 18th. And one of the kind of special situations that I had talked about in that interview was a very large net short position by the commercial hedgers, oil hedgers, and they used the futures market for that. And they were holding a record net short position. This with oil was trading about $60 a barrel, you know, or $55 a barrel. So my thesis then and my thesis now is that if they were wrong, in other words, the reason they were putting out those shorts at around $60 a barrel is because the smart money thought that oil prices were overpriced. Their oil was near a peak in price around $60. Well, they were wrong, and they're wrong to the tune of about $15 a barrel right now. If the market goes high enough, those shorts will have to cover. They'll have to throw in the towel. And if that happens, that could really kind of put the afterburners on this oil rally. So I've seen a little bit of liquidation in those shorts, but nothing like we saw back in around 08, a similar net short position where the hedgers got caught off sides, took oil from $70 a barrel to $130 a barrel. Now, I'm not saying we're going to go to 130. I think we could see 100, especially if we see more liquidation by the shorts. When I was on April 18th, oil prices are up 11% since then, and I had actually mentioned a couple of stocks. I mentioned Anadarko and Hess as two places to potentially put some ideas out there. Anadarko's up 16% since then, and Hess is up 18%. And I still have unmet targets in both of those that are significantly higher than those two stocks are right now. So, big move. I don't think it's over yet. The only place that our indicators, our metrics are showing opportunity here is in oil. And oil's always a tricky one because OPEC is involved and it's not governed by the typical supply and demand. There's other stuff involved there. It's controlled by a small group. But I do like oil, and I have upside targets in a number of stocks and ETFs that have not been hit yet. And oil-related, oil services, oil production are two areas of the energy sector that I really like, and I'm seeing a lot of opportunities in that space.
Yeah, I remember our last conversation in April when you brought up the fact that the commercials had a huge net short position. The last time they had that was back in 2007 and 2008 when oil spiked all the way up to almost $150 a barrel. The other group that has been wrong in this as well is a lot of these companies, especially in the shale space. I was really surprised to find out when we looked at first quarter earnings, John, that a lot of these companies, 15 out of the top 20 shale producers had hedged oil in the 50s. So as oil exploded over 60 and now over 70, they're not capturing those gains because they sold oil forward at a lower price.
That's exactly what I'm talking about. And that $55 area is actually probably where a lot of that hedging took place. I actually figured it out a few weeks ago, just how much collectively in the hole they are, so to speak, on these shorts that are under the market. And I, just off the top of my head, it was in excess of $4 billion. Now, you know, this isn't one hedger. This is a lot of hedgers and a lot of contracts. But that's a whole lot of money. And something interesting that I've seen is oil has had a really nice rally here over this past week or so. But open interest, and again, I don't want to get too wonky here, but futures open interest has continued to contract. And normally when you see a rally like this, you know, you see open interest expanding on a day-to-day basis, which indicates people are buying the futures and holding them overnight. It makes open interest get bigger. It's similar to watching asset flows in an ETF. You see the asset flows expand, that's a good sign because it tells you people are buying the ETF, holding it overnight. And that's kind of trend fuel to keep the ETF going higher. In this case, what contracting open interest amid higher prices means, when you look at the COT data, it means that their short covering is pushing this. So in other words, this looks like the beginning of short covering where the hedgers are starting to throw in the towel on their shorts because open interest isn't going up, it's going down. So they're actually liquidating contracts, selling them at higher prices. If this is the start of a liquidation phase by those hedgers, this thing could go a lot higher than it is right now.
Let's talk about a couple other things that, you know, as we start out this conversation, things that did not matter last year, whether it was political discord, rising oil prices, rising interest rates, didn't seem to matter. This year, those things are starting to have an impact on markets. Let's talk about the dollar, because Wall Street was forecasting higher profits because, you know, when you reduce the tax rates from 35 to 21%, you're going to have higher profits. But a lot of these companies, and maybe this is what we're seeing, John, in the S&P 500, or you're looking at the Dow stocks, a good majority of their sales and profits come from overseas. So if the dollar is on an uptrend, that has got to have an impact on their profits. Taking a look at the dollar today, where we're approaching that 95 level again, what's your take on the dollar here?
My take on the dollar here is for the near to intermediate term, 1 to 3 months out, I'm actually seeing indications that we're making some kind of a near-term peak in the dollar, you know, where the dollar's going to start to pull back here. We follow the dollar kind of secondarily here, and it's difficult to correlate the movements in the dollar with any particular asset. I mean, bonds probably is the one that it correlates to the best, but trying to correlate the dollar to the stock market, you just don't have the statistics there. But what we're looking at is after a really nice move higher in the dollar from mid to late April, I'm looking at the dollar index chart right now. You know, the rally is stalled, momentum is kind of coming out of there, and I see some, again, going back to the commitments of traders data, but you can get an indication of kind of what the smart money is doing, what the institutions are doing. They are actually making short bets on the dollar here, suggesting that at least over, you know, the next 1 to 3 months, the dollar's a little bit overpriced and is likely to pull back a bit.
So going from there, let's go to a final commodity that people follow, and that's gold. Gold has had difficulty breaking out above that 1350 level. And of course, a rising dollar is negative for gold. What's your take on gold? I mean, if the dollar is topping out, could we see a bounce?
Yeah, we could. Gold has been really kind of a disappointment. I'm actually looking at GLD. I'm looking at the ETF. I think, you know, a lot of listeners might follow that even more so than the, you know, the futures contract itself. GLD and gold have really been in a basing pattern since 2016, kind of bouncing around sideways. I had been watching this with interest for some time, and several failed attempts to break out higher. Beginning in late January, there was another one here in mid-February, another really good attempt at a breakout in mid-April. All of them have failed, and it's starting to roll back down. My fear is that any more weakness here, I think the level we really need to watch in gold is you have to watch that low. And again, GLD is what I'm looking at. 117.40 is the December 2017 low. So just about 18 months ago. If we break down through there, if we hold there, great. You know what? If the dollar pulls back, gold and the dollar are inversely correlated to each other. So if this little support level here around 118 even in GLD holds, that might be a near-term place to buy gold. Gold's acting terribly, and I don't advocate any long positions in gold, but you know, depending on what the dollar does, if the dollar pulls back in here, GLD holds 118, we could see a little rally into the summer as the U.S. currency weakens, you know, versus the rest of the world. If we break this 118 to 117.40 area, there could be a lot more pain involved for gold. So I'm not crazy about it, and I wouldn't advocate a buy in gold unless it showed me that it can hold some of the support. And I saw, you know, some weakness in the dollar to kind of support a gold rally. There's nothing here that indicates to me that we're near any kind of a investment time horizon opportunity to buy gold, just maybe a near-term bounce.
Finally, given where the markets are right now, we've got the major blue chip average, the Dow Industrials, Transports, and Utilities in negative territory for the year. You have the S&P 500 holding on to a small gain, the NASDAQ stocks and the small cap stocks obviously doing much better, but still in a downtrend. What would you be doing as an investor here?
What I've been doing lately is we have a model that I had built a few years ago that picks out stocks within a momentum environment. It did very well in 2017, saying 77 picks, and on average, each one beat the S&P by 1.5%, which is very hard to do in a market that goes up all the time the way it did in 2017. I've spent the past 2.5 months this year building a model that works on the premise of value, trying to buy a large decline. By large, I mean maybe 8 to 10% decline in a good stock that's been uptrending for a while, comes into support, and then we start to see some positive momentum characteristics. Frankly, that's been working pretty well here for the past couple of months, but it's picked out some. So I'm going into the weeds a little bit on you. I've actually built a model that will work better in a sideways to down environment for picking stocks. We call it Asbury Value. And I think maybe that's what you need to do now is be looking at good stocks that have been in long-term uptrends that have had a 10% pullback and are coming into some support levels. The reason for that is you don't know what the stock's going to do, you know, next week or, you know, next month. You know, nobody has a crystal ball that I know of. But if you can buy value breaks, if you could buy a good decline into a support level in a stock that's been strong, you know, for years and years and years, it gives you an opportunity where you can buy a stock with relatively low risk, because at that point, after you buy that kind of a break, if it continues to go lower, you know, you get out and the stock probably rolls into some kind of a negative market, you know, underneath its 200-day, let's say, for the next few months. But if you can buy them there, it gives you an opportunity to buy good stocks at a relatively low risk opportunity, where if the trend is still intact, the trends typically re-engage very quickly. And many of these that, again, I've only been at this a couple of months, we've got 35 trades closed out so far, but I'd say a quarter of them have risen by 12, 15% or more. So that's what I'm doing now, is rather than trying to buy a momentum breakout, which isn't really working in this environment, is I'm trying to find really good stocks that have had a pretty substantial break and trying to buy them at a value.
Well, listen, John, as we close, if our listeners would like to follow the great work you do at Asbury, tell them how they could do so.
The best way to contact us is through our website, asburyresearch.com, asbury research.com. There's a contact tab there. If you will complete that, and all it is your name and your email address, we will reach out to you and we'll send you some sample reports of what we're doing, you know, some current work, so you can see what we're doing, maybe see some of the charts I was talking about today with crude oil and gold and some of the foreign indexes that I was talking about. You get a little bit of an idea of what we do, and we have a couple of different price points for individual investors, for institutional investors, so get a chance to see what we're doing in real time, and if you like it, you know, we'd love to take you on as a client.
You're listening to the Financial Sense News Hour at financialsense.com. To speak to Jim Poplava or his financial planning team, call us toll-free at 888-486-3939. That's 888-486-3939. We'd be glad to help you plan your customized investment portfolio.
In case you didn't know it, the Financial Sense News Hour is more than just our weekend show. We also have a weekday program featuring key economic experts, which is only available to our premium members. Here's part of one of the interviews from this last week.
The tactics he's applying is very similar to his tactics he used in the New York real estate market. I mean, basically, in the real estate market, there is a lot of debt involved because it's a leveraged business, real estate. And the more debt there is, the more leverage a debtor has on his creditors. And Trump played that to the extreme, then sometimes even beyond. And I think in trade, it's exactly the same. The biggest importer of the world running the largest trade deficit is the U.S., and the biggest importer has a lot of leverage on the big exporters in the world. And Trump is applying the same tactics. He goes to extremes and may be going beyond extremes. And, of course, there are risks that it could break out in a real trade war. That's a problem. But I do believe that Trump has a fairly good chance to get a good deal before midterm election.
Well, this month may be some good news for consumers. Across the board, we're seeing a drop in agricultural prices from corn to wheat. What's behind all that? Will that lead to good news in the supermarket for consumers? Let's find out and talk to Ned Schmidt. Ned, as I look at ag prices for the month of June, we've got corn prices down 10, soybeans are down 12%. All across the board, ag has been very soft. Let's talk about what's behind it. Is this a trend, and will it lead to lower prices at the supermarket?
What's going on, Jim, is the massive tariffs being put on U.S. agriculture products by China. Next Friday is a big day, 6th of July, when a 20% across-the-board tariffs go into effect on U.S. ag exports to China. That's going to make U.S. grain prices non-competitive. And the exports to China have already dried up, because nobody felt they could get the crops to China before the tariffs went in. That same day next Friday, the U.S. will impose tariffs on Chinese imports from China. Now, what that's done is crushed U.S. grain prices. Now, the hope is that China will change their mind. And the reason for some hope is they had imposed 180% tariffs on sorghum, U.S. sorghum. They like U.S. sorghum because it's a non-genetically modified grain. And they can put on their bottle of Baijiu, which is their favorite liquor, non-GM, like we see on the labels in the United States. The internal pressure caused that tariff to be dropped. The second thing going on is next month, which is just around the corner, the tariffs and VAT on U.S. pork will be 88% of the value, which means nobody's going to import U.S. pork into China. That's where the issue starts to get cloudy for China, because all those companies in China that were importing U.S. pork are going to go out of business, and all of their employees are going to be laid off. How that plays out in China is going to influence their policies. So it's China problem that's developed. As of right now, it does not look like China is going to back off.
Is there an alternative source to U.S. grains? I mean, can they go to Argentina? Can they go to Russia? Are there other places they can go to replace what they're importing from the U.S.? In other words, how easy is it to replace what U.S. farmers produce?
The one that's most easily replaced, in theory, if you're an economist that wears a white shirt and tie and works in the 25th floor of a building in Chicago, he says you just go to Brazil and buy them because they're a big soybean producer. Well, that's easier said than done. The reason the U.S. is such a large and successful egg producer is we're blessed with some good dirt, but we were also blessed with the best transportation system in the world. The Mississippi River system, and the trains of the West. Brazilians' transportation sector is still mired somewhere in the 20th century. I'm not sure in reality that they can move enough soybeans to replace American soybeans. So it's a good strategy, but it may be one very difficult to execute. Russia's big export commodity is wheat. We have all the wheat we need. The world has all the wheat it wants. And so they're not going to ship wheat to China because China doesn't import wheat. They only import about 4 to 5 million tons of corn, which they can gather from anywhere. So is China going to be willing to accept the unemployment that's coming out of this and the higher prices they're going to have to pay? Because ultimately they're going to have to import some U.S. grain. They just can't escape it. So there's no change in their policy yet. That's going to keep grain prices down, crush hog prices. How long it goes on, I don't know, Jim. I'm somewhat fairly optimistic on ag that they might modify their view.
I want to go to two agricultural ETFs. One is DBA, which has been in a downtrend, although it's getting a spike on this Friday. And the other one is DBC, which has been in an uptrend. Explain the difference between the two and what's causing them to go in opposite directions.
DBA has 3, 6, 9, 10 commodities in it. The problem is it's a fairly poorly designed portfolio. In other words, according to this portfolio, nobody in the world eats rice. Nobody in the world eats chickens, that kind of stuff. No sorghum, which has been our hottest export. This DBA was created to make it easy for their traders to emulate it in the futures market. This is not a commodity index. This is an index of commodity futures. And that's the essential problem, because it's not inclusive enough. That's the principal answer.
All right. Then let's take two other companies that are dealing with grains, and they're the biggies, Bunge and ADM. Same problem. Archer Daniels Midland is doing well. Bunge is doing poorly. What's going on there?
Archer Daniels is the attractive one in the sector now, because they're internationally diversified. They can source some product out of South America. So that's not their historical strong suit. So I like ADM, and I think it's the stock in the ag sector that is going to draw people. BG has persistent management problems. They really should have sold that company to somebody else. But it has good, strong exposure to Brazil. So if there is an attempt to access Brazilian grains, BG might benefit from it. And there's still some hope that either Archer Daniels or Glencore, the commodity trader, might buy them. And I think that Archer Daniels is going to replace, and probably has replaced, Deere as a stock that traders are interested in. Deere has a serious problem as long as the tariffs stay on U.S. grains, because Deere is largely a North American machinery company. Now, sales in May were just off the charts. I mean, they were strong in the United States. For some reason, I can't discern. The other one that looks interesting, and I think is going to be, is the DuPont Ag subsidiary when it comes out. It's spun off. And I think that's going to happen in January. The concern right now I have, Jim, is what happens to the cash flow of U.S. farmers while this goes on. And it is going to seriously damage those cash flows, which makes me worry about next spring's planting in the U.S. We could see plantings weak simply because farmers don't have the cash to invest. So the consequence of this would be higher prices next year than we would have thought. All right, on DVC, DVC is a generic commodity index, Jim, and it's got crude oil, heating oil, gasoline, sweet light crude, gold. The gold part is probably hurting.
Okay, so the energy component is probably a strong driver of that.
Yeah, that's right.
So let me ask you this. If this tariff gets put into place, the Chinese hold and take a stand, we take a stand, this goes on for a while, this could affect the crop plantings for next year. We already have inflation that is growing in this country right now, whether it's from energy prices, rising labor prices. So this could lead to higher food prices because, you know, I don't need to tell anybody listening to the show, you're going to the supermarket. I don't care if you're looking at meats or you're looking at vegetables, produce, all that stuff is going up.
Well, a lot of that too, Jim, is the cost of gasoline to get it there. And the retailers, I think, have been expanding their margins. We have high employment, good wages in the United States, especially out where you live. So they are marking things up, which you would expect them to do. Because of the strong component that's the cost of retailing, transportation, and waste, I think we're stuck with high prices for those. Jim, the waste in the produce sector is just horrendous. You would never consciously import produce if you realized how much it was going to get wasted.
Yeah, that's the one thing about supermarkets in the U.S., at least in California, you can get anything any time of the year. There is no thing as seasonality. If you want berries, you can get it any time of the year. If we don't grow them at this time, we'll import them from someplace else in the world. And maybe that's explaining some of the transportation costs are driving up the cost of food.
Right. Now, in looking at the CTF, it made me think of something I meant to mention. The one commodity that looks like it's putting in a bottom, and I wouldn't go buy any sugar, but it looks like that price is washed out. Now, how long it stays on the bottom, it's kind of bobbing around like a fishing bobber. Sugar looks like it's putting in a bottom. If that's the case, then both BG and ADM will benefit from that because they're both in the sweetener business, and BG is in the sugar business in Brazil. That's been a drag as those sugar prices have been coming down. So if they just flatten, it's going to help the bottom line. And if we get an uptick in sugar next year, both of those companies will benefit from that.
Let me turn to weather because we got the harvest coming up here in a couple of months. And then, of course, we'll go through the winter season and then another planting season. When you talk about how U.S. farmers may be impacted by tariffs, so if they don't have the cash flow because of the tariffs placed on our exports, they may not have the money to plant for next year, which could drive higher prices. What about the rest of the world and the weather pattern?
The rest of the world is eating good. And is the weather going to be a factor? It's always a factor. But it looks like it could be a factor this year because it's hotter and drier than I think most of the weather people were forecasting. And Australia's been in a drought, maybe some in Russia. So it's always an issue. But as you know, the weather doesn't always match up with the forecast.
So as you look at prices right now, and as you look at stocks in the sector, from an investment point of view, what looks better to you right now? The commodities themselves, as you mentioned, sugar may be bottoming, or the stocks?
I think there's going to be an aversion to buying the commodities. In other words, right now, what's going on is anybody that's managing an inventory of grains, say you work for a bread company or a pastry company or something, there's no incentive to build inventories. You're still trying to shed them. So I think the stocks are going to offer more opportunities. It just may not be all of the ag stocks. Deer is not one in favor right now. AGCO could get some attention because it only gets 25% of its revenues from the U.S. and 75% from outside the U.S.
The thing that really strikes me about this sector is how few companies dominate it. I mean, if you're looking at distributors, you've got basically one or two companies, Archer Daniels Midland, you got Bunge. When it comes to tractor companies, there are only two or three. When it comes to seed companies, two or three. The industry is really dominated by a few large giants. How did we get there?
The problem is, I don't think we were ever really much in a different situation in the last 20 years. You have to have a certain amount of scale to be in the grain movement business. In other words, it's not an industry where mom and pop can enter it. And there was no need for more companies because the system, particularly in the United States, is so efficient, there's not a need for a plethora of companies. And remember, we lost Monsanto, we lost Syngenta, and there's these two companies, FMC and the ag sub out of coming out of Dow DuPont. So there really isn't need for a whole bunch of companies. And you have to have such a large scale to make a profit in the business. Remember, we have two commodity companies like Bunge and ADM that aren't public, Glencore and Louis Dreyfus. But those four big companies, you don't need a lot more.
So in terms of investment point of view, you can either play the commodities. And one of the things I've never liked about some of the commodity funds is most of the time futures markets are in contango. So when you're rolling over each month, you're not making money. It's really when you get into backwardation that the futures market works well for a fund. So how do you invest in this sector? Do you just pick a company like ADM, a tractor company like Deere? And as since there's so few companies, is that what you do? I mean, that's how you cover the sector?
And that's the only way for the individual investor to do it. Because like Las Vegas, the futures market was designed to separate individuals from their money. Okay? The futures market wasn't designed for people like you and me to make money, Jim. It was designed to take money from us. And so the operations of it aren't geared to the little investor. It's like, I don't know that if the large commercials had inside information on China, but before the China announcements were starting to leak out, they were short over 2 million bushels of corn. And so I don't know that they had inside information, but it sure looks like they did. Somebody in China leaked it to them. But again, the part of the issue is how much pain is China willing to withstand? They've lost $2 trillion in their stock markets, down over 20%. It's in a bear market. The Chinese are so worried that if we agree that the 6th is Friday, on Thursday, the Chinese central bank is freeing up $100 billion in reserves to keep companies afloat. Do they want to keep the heat on? Is it worth the gain to take that kind of pain? I don't know. China is a much more political country than we imagine here in America. We see it as an authoritative dictatorship. Well, they actually behave just like politicians in the United States. So we'll see next week how much pain they're willing to take.
So from a negotiating point of view, is the U.S. in a better position from playing hardball with China, or is China in a better position?
No. China sells us over $500 billion in stuff. We sell them $130 billion. The big customer has a lot to say in how things are done. It's the same problem that Canada's got. Canada announced some kind of tariffs today, and which really surprised me. I mean, they treat our ag products unfairly. 250 to 290% tariffs on our dairy products. If you import U.S. wheat into Canada, you cannot use it to make anything people eat. You can only feed it to animals, which means we get a miserable price for wheat we sell to Canada. On the West Coast, you go to Vancouver, you cannot buy a U.S. wine or spirit. Same thing in Ontario. So Canada doesn't have a lot of defense in what they're doing. And Trudeau is playing a dangerous game because Ontario province recently threw out the Liberals en masse and installed a conservative government. Ontario is the most vulnerable province in Canada. We don't have any state in the United States that comes even close. 49% of their revenues and businesses in Ontario province come from exports to the United States. You cannot be more vulnerable than that. So I don't know, I'm sure you and I agree that global trade is good, but we're facing an extremely unfair situation when it comes to dealing with some countries.
So I guess when you're the largest buyer in the world, that gives you negotiating power. Listen, Ed, as we close, given where we are right now, we've got falling ag prices this month. And as you mentioned, it's probably influenced by what's going on with the trade tariffs that could be influenced next month or put into place next week. Where would you be putting money if you were putting money in the ag sector right now?
I would look at Archer Daniels. I don't know that AgCo would do anything right now, but it is well positioned for the future. The DowDuPont thing, you're going to get the company split up in January. I think that's going to be a stock that portfolio managers at the institutional levels are going to have to put in their portfolio because there just aren't any other alternatives. So I think there are, but you got to not look at it, at least for the present time, as a price play. You got to look at it as a play on the individual company's characteristics.
Well, listen, Ned, as we close, you're one of the few people I know that covers the ag sector. If our listeners would like to follow the work that you do, tell them how they can find you.
My website is agrifoodvalueview.com. And it's been a pleasure, Jim.
Always a pleasure. And we'll see what happens next week and we'll see who blinks first.
Coming up next in the Financial Sense News Hour, Greg Weldon is Jim's guest as the big picture rolls forward today, taking shelter in the storm as we examine stagflation, rising budget deficits, and higher inflation rates, and discussing why the Fed may be using hawkish language, but not be quite as hawkish as the markets might anticipate. There are new storms that are coming, and the markets aren't discussing them. All of that coming up next on the Financial Sense News Hour at financialsense.com.
The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertised with Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.